the very sort of last message of this series that we have done all year, starting way back in January of last year, called It All Belongs to God. And what we've done is sort of taken a real systematic, slow work through, starting in Genesis, working through history, just kind of examining what does it look like for God, who is intimately involved in every aspect of his creation. What does it look like for God as he has moved and worked through people and cultures and time in the world throughout history? And we see that there is nothing that happens randomly or by accident, but God is intimately involved in all of the details of the unfolding ribbon of history, and that we know will happen all the way into glory at the end when we see Jesus face to face, when he will come back to earth and reign. We're going to take a little bit of a shift after we've kind of laid that foundation of understanding how God has worked in the world to spend some time talking about, well, how then should we live our lives? In light of the fact that it all belongs to God, what does that look like for us to live as his people today, right now, where God has put us? So Dan is going to kick that off next week, and I think you guys will be excited to this coming year, the things that we have in store for you. All right, I'm going to start with an apology. Some of you I know have, on occasion, said something to me, maybe even walked by me and just said, "Hello, Noah," and I totally ignored you, didn't turn, listen, look, or say anything to you. And the reason why is my hearing is horrible. So I promise I was not ignoring you. I just couldn't hear you. My wife has a word for it. She says, it's not that you're deaf, it's selective hearing. I think it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, I can't hear well, but it's nice to be able to use that as an excuse when you don't want to respond to people. Dan has worked with me for a little more than 2 years now, and Dan says that he can tell just by the expression on my face whether or not I heard what he said. He said he can just tell. He can look at my face and see if I'm recognizing or hearing what he says. It sometimes is very embarrassing, get me in a lot of trouble. This last week at staff meeting, Lori Mason, who runs our children's ministry, she was talking about some stuff that's gone on in her house that's displaced her from her home for a couple of days. And she was telling John, and I don't know, probably 3 or 4 minutes of explaining to John what's happened. And I said, she's done it. I said, so Lori, are you back in your house yet? Because I did not hear any of the conversation. So it can be very embarrassing and get me in a lot of trouble. But you know what? I bet there have been times where all of you have had the opportunity to share the amazing things that are going on in your life as God is teaching you and challenging you and growing you and stretching you, and you're talking with someone who may not have any idea who Jesus is or what it means to follow him. And as you're sharing this great news about what's going on in your life, you can see in other people's faces that they don't get it, that they don't understand at all the excitement and what you're talking about when you're talking about God and who he is and the difference that he's making in your life. That's what I want to talk about with you this morning. I want to talk about what does it look like for us to craft a message that will allow us to have a hearing with the people that God puts in our life. Dan is sitting right here. So Dan, Taz, can you close his ears? Because if I say this with him listening, he's going to have a big head and you're going to put up with it all night. So if you didn't hear Dan last week, he was really sharp walking through Acts chapter 17. I'm going to have to live with this all week long. It was really good last week. So if you were not here and you didn't get an opportunity to hear Dan, go online or pick up one of the CDs afterwards and listen to him as he walks through Paul and his interaction with the people in Athens and the hearing that he had, the opportunity to have a hearing with the people there and how effective Paul was. And Dan just kind of walked through and broke down that strategy. What I want to do is I want to just kind of revisit for a couple of minutes here with you as we start. What was the setting where Paul found himself? Why was he so effective? And then I want to look kind of like at America today and see, well, let's compare and contrast what it was like to live in Athens 2,000 years ago and what it's like to live in America today. So the first thing we find out is Athens was full of idols. Remember that? Dan talked about that you were going through the marketplace, the agora there, and there were all of these podiums, and on the podiums they would have these statues. Because there are so many gods, you didn't want to offend a god, and you wanted to do your best to honor God. So the people, you find out that the objects of their passion are in full view, what they're dedicated to, what they worship, what garners their attention, what they spend their time, energy, chasing after or trying to please in their life. It was also a very religious culture. Very pluralistic, though. It wasn't like everybody had the same religion. There were a lot of competing philosophies about what it looked like to how to best live your life, what it meant to honor God, who were the most important gods that deserved your attention. It was very pluralistic, but it was a very religious and philosophical city. It was hugely influential. Granted, it was past its prime, but in all of the Roman Empire, there was no town that had as much influence over the rest of culture in terms of poetry, plays, high culture, high thinking. It all still was contained in Athens. It wasn't a huge town, only about 10,000 people, which is very moderate by the big towns in the Roman Empire at the time. But there was no place that had more sway, more influence over the rest, even more than Rome in terms of the popular culture of the empire during its day there. Of course, we know that Socrates and Plato and a number of other great philosophers, that's where they called home and had their schools that they set up. The people there were extremely pragmatic. They were very practical and guided by very practical principles in their life. Dan and I were talking this morning just about today, you know, the word that we would use is not necessarily pragmatic, but maybe existential. They were driven by their experiences that helped them determine what was true in life and how to make decisions as to what you do in life and how you treat other people and what it meant to get along in the world. It was very wealthy, very opulent. They had so much money to spend. This is part of why they were influential in the world. You know, they had money to spend on jewelry in a way that most other towns in the empire didn't have the opportunity. So the women had earrings and necklaces and braided their hair in beautiful ways that it was what set the sort of the fashion statement for the rest of the Roman Empire, how the people dressed. You know, it was the sort of place where the men would look in their glass or in their patio pool, and they would make sure that their toga was just so. And you know, you wanted to make sure you had 1, 2, 3, 4 ruffles, you know, on the shoulder. And if you went out in public and you only had 3, it would be like walking around with your fly down, you know, if you're a guy. You wouldn't do that. You know what I mean? They were concerned about all of those sort of opulent things that most of the rest of the Roman Empire that was just bent on trying to survive and make it day to day, they had the opportunity to pursue these kind of excesses in life that most of the rest of the people didn't have the opportunity to do. As a result of that, you know what? They thought of themselves, you know, if you were from Athens, you told people your address, you know, that this came from that you whatever letter you shipped, you know, if you were going on vacations and you were going to Athens, you told everybody. It was a little bit of snobbery because you felt like you were just a little better than everybody else in the rest of the empire if that was your home. But that was 2,000 years ago. That's where Paul found himself in Athens and the culture that he found himself in. What about us in America today? How is our world different than Paul's? Well, it's interesting because what do we find? Our towns and our lives are what? Our cities are full of idols. And you don't even have to go to the marketplace to see them anymore. All you have to do is drive down the street and you can see people's homes, their cars, their toys, all that stuff stacked in their driveway that they spend their time, money, and energy chasing after, thinking that that's what will grant them pleasure in life. We're very religious, aren't we, in our culture also? It's a very pluralistic kind of religion. Not everybody agrees to the same set of morals and standards, but still, survey after survey still show that more than 80% of people in America believe that there is a God or some kind of higher power. in the universe. We're very philosophical, and we have a whole branch of competition about what it looks like to live the way, you know, what's the best way to live. Very much like the life in Athens. America is hugely influential in the rest of the world, aren't we? We export our culture all over the world, and the rest of the world really has, even in our economic downturn, the rest of the world chases after what is American. And we export not only what is good about our culture, but sometimes what is not so good. And you wonder why sometimes other countries don't hold America in very high esteem, because not only do we send what is good about our country to other places, but also a lot of the trash. And people there recognize the trash that we export to the rest of the world. Some people think that, you know, just to think about how we're influenced in our own lives by the culture of living in America. Because I run into people, especially my high school students, go, well, I'm not influenced by the rest of culture. And I think that's it's so funny because the way we dress, the way we talk, it's all influenced by what? By what goes on around us. You can't help. It's like the air that you breathe. It's so unconscious that we inhale what is going on and what is being promoted, how we talk, language, all of that kind of stuff has an influence on us. If you don't believe me, go home and look at your wedding album and look at the tuxedo that you wore when you got married in. You know that powder blue tuxedo with the ruffles here that you wouldn't be caught dead wearing. In fact, you're embarrassed. You, when your friends come over, you put the picture down on the mantle so nobody will see what you wore. It's funny because my son Levi yesterday was up at Sierra competing at his first snowboard competition, and afterwards in the raffle he got some stuff. And part of the competition is sponsored by Vans. And I was looking at the wallet and I go, I had one of those wallets just like that. And the colors and the shirt, and I go, man, when I was in junior high, I was wearing that. I wouldn't be caught dead in that. But I guess, you know, all this stuff is coming back around. It made me want to take out my, you know, one of my old surf albums with pictures in there and show Levi my neon, you know, green and day glow colored, you know, wetsuits that I wore, you know. And, you know, this stuff is coming back around, I guess. You never know. But, you know, the way we dress, the way we talk, we're all hugely influenced by popular culture in the world that we live in. And we export what we're influenced here out to the rest of the world. We're also very pragmatic, aren't we? We're very practical. In fact, one of the things that makes it difficult to live in America is if you're a passionate follower of Jesus, you've got all these principles that you understand from the Scripture. You look at the life of Jesus and you say, you know, if that's what it looks like to pursue God, that kind of lifestyle, you chase after it. But you recognize that living in America, we've got this sort of practical way to get along, get things done in relationships and business that sometimes comes in conflict with that Christ-honoring life that we're trying to lead. So you've got these two worlds that sometimes collide that can make it a challenge to live the kind of life that God asks us to live. We are wealthy beyond means. I was talking with John recently about what it means to be poor in America. You might think of the person who's out in front of a fast food restaurant and they have a sign and they're asking for a dollar or a meal. And that person, compared to your standard in here or my standard, they're poor. But you know, that person will make, in a half an hour, more money than a third of the people alive in the world today. And they will consume more calories than almost two-thirds of most of the people in the rest of the world. Even our poor in America are wealthy compared to the standard of living of most of the rest of the world. We are extremely wealthy, and we don't even recognize how much wealth we have. I think as a result of this, there is a little bit of arrogance sometimes we have as Americans. We feel like maybe we are just a little bit better than everyone else. I show you this just to say, you know what? Paul lived 2,000 years ago, and we kind of marvel at the hearing and the strategy that he had to be able to talk to other people effectively about who God was and what he was doing. And you know, here's the thing. Dan laid out Paul's strategy last week, what that looked like for him to engage the popular culture where he lived. Well, you know what? I don't think it's a stretch to understand that Paul lived in Athens, was in Athens 2,000 years ago, but his culture really was not all that different from where you and I find ourselves today in South Lake Tahoe. And I think that it's not a stretch to understand that what worked for Paul, for him to be able to craft a message where he could talk about the timeless realities of who God was and how God was alive and at work in the world today, he was able to do that even though the context that he found himself in was different from some of the other towns that he found himself in. And I think likewise, we can talk about those timeless truths about God, who he is, how he's working in the world, by understanding our current cultural context. That's what makes Paul so unique, isn't it? It's one of the things that we love about Paul. See, Paul was raised as in kind of the aristocratic class of his day. He was a Pharisee. So he was on the upper echelon of the Jewish teachers of the day. He knew all about Judaism. He had the Old Testament memorized from front to back. He knew all about the traditions. He knew everything about Jewish culture. He knew all of the idiosyncrasies of what it meant to be a Jew anywhere in the world at that time. And he was able to use a dialogue that no matter where you were in the Roman Empire, you could understand exactly what Paul was saying about life and about what it meant to pursue God. But you see, here's what was so different about Paul compared to almost everybody else alive at that time. Paul could go to a place like Athens that may have had a very small Jewish community, people that had all sorts of other traditions that came from a completely different culture than what he was raised in. They had their own sort of subculture of language and traditions. And Paul was able to talk just as effectively to those non-Jews as he was the Jewish people. He could go into a town like Athens, so different than the culture that he was reared in, that he was an expert in, and still have an effective hearing with the people. If you have your Bibles, open up to 1 Corinthians 9:22. See, this is the key of what Paul talks about. He says, I try to find, and circle this in your Bible, common ground with everyone so that I might bring them to Christ. Paul wanted to know who you were, how you thought, how you reasoned, what your logic system was. And he wanted to know it better than you did so that he could talk, argue, reason with you from a common place of understanding. Have you ever had a conversation with someone? Heather and I were having this discussion this afternoon. She made a great point. Have you ever had a discussion with someone where they've never been to church before? They've never read the Bible. They know nothing about Jesus. And yet they'll tell you how ridiculous it is for you to believe what you believe. But they've never examined it for themselves. But yet they still feel like they can tell you how foolish it is for you to embrace the belief system that you have. How do you react when someone does that with you? Are you going to listen? Do you listen to them? Your heart and your mind, are you open to what they have to say to you? Of course not. You recognize it's ridiculous because you don't know anything about my shoes and what it means to walk and pursue what I am in my own life. Why then is it any different for you to go and talk to someone else who has a different set of beliefs, a different understanding about the world, a different religious perspective, and you as a Christian go to them and you say, it's so ridiculous that you believe what you believe. It's so foolish to embrace that philosophy. And we think that they're going to hear us. Why would they? See, but if you go to those people, you understand their culture, their tradition, their background, why they think the way they think, do you think you might have some common understanding, a place to start with, to have a productive dialogue where you might have a hearing with those people in the capacity that you wouldn't have if you didn't take the time and energy to understand those people, who they were, and what made them, how they operated. Paul, we understand this illustration of how Paul understood the culture that he lived in. There are at least four full quotes that Paul uses writing in the New Testament These are three different authors. These are a couple of examples. There's several other partial quotes, but one was a Cretan poet, philosopher. Another one was a Sicilian poet. Another one was a Greek poet. And you can see there, they come from four different original writings. What does that tell you that about Paul and his willingness to find common ground with his audience? See, he wanted to be able to reason with them from a common place of understanding. He read their works. He understood their language. He understood their philosophies. That's why Paul was so effective in talking with other people, because he knew the world he lived in. See, people sometimes say to me, they go, all you need to do is read the Bible, and that's enough to be a Christian in the world today. That's all that matters. I don't think that's true. I think that if you want to have a hearing with other people, if you want to have the opportunity to influence other people, you need to know something about who they are, how they operate, what they think. And if you don't believe me, take the example of Jesus himself. Jesus didn't come down from heaven and use all this religious jargon to get people to understand what it meant to pursue God passionately. He used everyday, simple language and illustrations that the average person could understand in the culture that he came to. You and I sometimes read the stories about Jesus where he talks about farming and food and it growing and it being ripe, planting. And like for most of us, we're like, I don't even have a garden at my house. You know, and when I want water for it, all I do is go turn on the hose. But Jesus came into an agrarian society where 80% of the people grew food to maintain, take care of their families. So Jesus used what? He used farming stories about planting, reaping, sowing, ripening, rain coming at just the right time because that was critical for their crops. See, Jesus didn't use a whole bunch of crazy religious jargon with the people of Israel that knew religious jargon to understand what it meant to follow God. Jesus used simple, everyday stories about banquets, getting together and having dinner. They were a culture that all got together all the time. They all knew what it meant to farm. See, Jesus spoke a language that the world and culture that he came into for them to be able to understand. So when you say, all I need to do is read the Bible, all I need to be able to do is quote verses to my neighbor and they'll get it, that's all that God expects from me, I'd say, I don't think that's a very examined philosophy about what it looks like to live in the world where God placed you today. I was watching the movie Avatar this week, and if you're like most Americans, they say that almost 50% of Americans have watched this movie. How many of you in here, first service, at least 50% of people have seen it? There's about a third of you in here that have seen it so far. See, I don't think it's hard to be able to recognize that popular culture gives us some outstanding opportunities to talk about God and who he is and what he's doing in the world. Avatar, I actually, to be honest with you, puts me in the minority of people. I wasn't that impressed with the movie. I thought it was pretty predictable. But, I mean, for sure, there's no question about it. The graphics, the visual imagery is absolutely incredible. It's unbelievable what they've done in that movie in terms of visual arts. But beyond just the visual arts, there are some very powerful undercurrents of a worldview that James Cameron has purposely put in that movie. He's got all sorts of political statements in there. He has statements right out of speeches from our presidents, past presidents. There's all sorts of spiritual undertones. It's like so many other Hollywood movies that it's heavily pantheistic, that somehow nature ought to be the object of our worship. So it's got all sorts of environmental overtones and relational overtones in it. Dan talked a couple weeks ago about his high school track girls getting together, and they were talking about it, and there was sort of like this, talk about it sort of like it's Valhalla, you know, like it's wouldn't it be great if this was what life was like? I was talking with someone after second service who really enjoyed the movie, and they're not a regular church goer. In fact, it was the first time they come to church in a long time. And I said, well, let's talk, let's get together, and we'll have some conversations about this. Because what happens in that movie is, see, that movie sort of paints a picture of what I think people think heaven would look like, or what it would look like to really live, you know, an ideal way of living. But you see, if you read the scriptures and you understand what God's kingdom is like, there are some things that may be similar to what you see in Avatar, but there are also some very sharp distinctions. And it gives you an awesome opportunity, a common ground platform, to have some, I think, really unique conversations with other people just based on things that are a part of popular culture that everybody sees and understands. The planet that they're from that the movie takes place on is called Pandora, which has all sorts of neat overtones to be able to talk with people about. The people in the movie are called the Na'vi people. And James Cameron, not on accident, picked a word that is a Hebrew word from our Old Testament. You know what that Hebrew word means? Prophet. I don't think it's hard to understand that what James Cameron was doing was a little bit of his own prophecy, foretelling about the world that we live in and what we ought to be pursuing, what our values ought to be. That movie has some very prophetic overtones. It's not accidental that he chose that word. If you know this stuff, if you think about this stuff, it really gives you some neat opportunities to have some pretty profound conversations with other people. But you know, hasn't that always been true? You know, Mick Jagger singing, I can't get no satisfaction. When songs like that are popular, it's sort of, you know, the reason that songs like that become popular is because it resonates with people about how they feel about life. Knowing that kind of stuff can be the basis for opportunities to talk with other people. Why can't you find satisfaction in life? What would it look like to be satisfied in life? If you understand that pop culture is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's an opportunity in the world that you and I live in to have some common ground conversations with other people. Paul teaches us something that was true of him, and it's true of us, how important it is to know the culture that you live in. If you want to talk with other people, you want to have a hearing, you've got to figure out how to take that timeless message, a bold message. Paul didn't back down at all about the bold claims of what God had done for them and the coming judgment, but he crafted it in a contextual way that the people where he lived could understand it. How do you do that today? You talk with other people about that? Have you thought about what words to use? Young people today, they are so far removed from an Enlightenment era. You know, it's so postmodern that most of my kids working in Monterey, they grew up in such kind of a non-theology-oriented world that when I said, you're a sinner and you need Jesus in your life, half of my kids would have looked at me like, I have no idea who Jesus is. This is one of the first times I've ever heard his name other than a swear word. I don't even know what the word sin means. And so I'm talking to them in my church language, my Enlightenment era language, to postmodern kids that have no context for which to put that conversation in. You've got to learn who your audience is and be able to use a vocabulary that they can understand. And every culture has its own unique vocabulary, stories, ideas, traditions that allow you to communicate effectively with them. It's important that you are a conscientious consumer. Knowing that we inhale culture like air, it's important that you're able to critique what you see, what you watch, what you listen to. Understanding and recognizing that things that you take into your ears, into your eyes, into your mind, it affects the way you think, live, talk, and act. It's important that we're conscious of that and we can critique all of culture, because the reality is God called us not to reject culture, but God calls us to build culture. He wants us involved in it. He wants us to kind of create the culture, what? That honors Him, that reflects His beauty, His creativity, using the gifts that God has given each one of you. He expects you to be a part of making the world more like His kingdom. That's part of culture building. God expects you to be engaged in that, not to reject it, but to use that stuff to make the world more the way God wants it to do. So we need to understand what's worth celebrating in the culture that we live in. What can we say, oh, that's a God thing, that's a beautiful thing, that's the way God intended for us to live, work, play, talk, create. We also need to be able to say, there are some things that we create that are worth condemning, and we ought to say that publicly, in our families, in the places where we live, work, and play. We need to know what is worth turning our eyes away from. We need to know what is worth not putting in our heads through our ears. We need to recognize that stuff. The great theologian Karl Barth, one of the more contemporary good theologians in many ways, in a Time magazine article, he says, talking about Christians and pastors, he says, we ought to take our Bible in one hand and our newspaper in the other, using the scriptures to interpret the time that we live in, but to understand the time that we live in and how to interact with people. I think that today maybe a contemporary way of understanding that would be to say, you ought to have your Bible in one hand and your iPhone in the other, you know, as we go and we try and navigate what it looks like to be God's people in the world that we live in today. I was in Starbucks several months ago. I try and go there a couple times a week to study, to get out of the office and be around other people and get away from the phone calls and stuff like that and the emails, and gives me a different perspective and just to be out in the community and talk with people in the parking lot and whatever. And I walk into Starbucks, and there is a guy sitting in there that I've seen a couple of other times, and he's got a shirt that on the back has a religious philosophy in words written on the back. And I thought, that's really interesting. I'd like to talk with him about it. I went and got my drink, and I came back, and I sat down across from him, and he's engrossed in this book that he's reading. And so I wonder, well, what's this guy reading? So I kind of, slouch down lower and lower and lower in my chair so I can get a glimpse of, the underpinning of his book. And I read it, and I wrote it down on my iPhone. I went back to the office and I ordered the book. And it's a religious philosophical book. I got it on a Monday and I just sort of started perusing it. And I'm back in Starbucks. This is like 2 weeks later. I'm back in Starbucks on a Thursday. And guess who's in there? So I introduce myself to him. And we start having this conversation. I didn't tell him right away that I had looked at what book he read, but this next, we actually talked three times now, and what's interesting is, you see, just the little bit of investigation I did reading this book gave me an insight into his world that I would not have had otherwise to be able to have the basis of the conversations that we've had. He found out that I was a pastor right away, and so he didn't want to hear any religious pastoral advice. But we had some great conversations about what do you believe, what are you doing here in town, how did you get here, all that kind of stuff. But having just a little bit of insight into his thinking and philosophy gave us some pretty outstanding conversations. This last time I talked with him, it was the third time I've talked with him, he actually asked me a question, sort of an evaluation question. How does what I think, from my perspective as a Christian, how does that compare or contrast to what he believes? I don't think if I didn't have that common platform to be able to talk with him from, I'm not sure that we would have had the quality of conversation that we had. And I'm not sure that he would have been all that interested in what I as a pastor would have had to say to him. Oprah Winfrey is another great example of this. Oprah has somewhere between 20 and 40 million people that watch her show every week. And they watch it religiously. And Oprah kind of dispenses her own religious philosophies. So I don't think it does us any harm if we live in a world where those people that watch Oprah, listen to Oprah, take those things that they learn from her out in everyday conversation with other people. There's this trickle-down effect that affects the culture that we live in. So I've read some of Eckhart Tolle's books because he's been a guest on that show. And I know that kind of thinking resonates with her and the people that watch her show. I want to be able to talk to people, and I want to know what does this guy teach? What does he think? What's his philosophy? If I'm going to have a hearing and understanding and be able to have a conversation from a common ground, I need to know some of that stuff. Oprah had a book club that she did for a number of years, and occasionally I'd go and I'd They're books that I didn't want to read. I looked at the title and I thought, you got to be kidding me. But I'd get them and I'd start reading through them just because I want to know what other people in the culture that I live in think, understand, why they reason what they do, what's popular with them, what words, how do they speak, what's their vocabulary of those people on the street when they're having conversations with other people that I, who live, work, talk in the church 90% of my time, I don't want to get so disconnected that I can't talk with those people as a regular person. I don't want them to look at me and say, well, that guy's like a priest who doesn't have any idea what it's like to live in America. I don't want to be that disconnected from our culture. And it's so easy to do as Christians, isn't it? To fall back into our little fortress and speak our own little church language and do our own little church thing and not ever get to know our neighbors or the people that we work with. And when we do, all we do is we speak our church language and pray and hope that that will get through to them, never willing to try and find common ground to which to speak to those people from in a platform, using a timeless message in a bold way, but understanding the context and the language and the culture that we have today. As a youth pastor, I used to, and I still do it, it's become such a habit, but I started watching the Teen Choice Awards. And you want to talk about torture. You know, in hell, they're going to have to watch reruns of the Teen Choice Awards. Oh, it's so bad. But if you want to understand what popular culture, what are kids watching, listening to, seeing, what's shaping their world that they live in today, man, it'll give you in a 2.5 hour, you know, splotch. And if you fast forward through the commercials, thank God, you know, because they're all teeny bop commercials. But if you want to understand kids today, what their culture is like, how they talk, how they think, how they reason, and what's resonating with them, it's a great investment of a couple hours once a year. And I did that as a youth pastor because I wanted to know my kids and I wanted to know how to connect with them ever deeper on what they were thinking, how they talked, what they were looking at, why they were making the choices that they made, who they were following, who had influence in their life. As Christians, I think that we're called to be aware of that stuff. We need to be conscious. We can't be mindless consumers of culture. We need to be good critiques of it. But if you want to have a hearing with other people, I think it's indispensable in your ability to communicate with other people who God is and what he's done. I want to give you just a little bit of homework here real quick. There is a class that Pastor Dan and Tom Barnes teach here. It's called, it's our 401 class. And it's called Three-Story Living, and what it is talking about three stories that matter. And so I want you to go home, and one of the things that I believe and understand from this class is that practice makes perfect. One of the reasons it's hard for us to talk with other people in a compelling way about who God is and what he's doing in our life and in the world today is because we haven't practiced it. We haven't shared with other people, our own spouses, our own kids. We haven't talked about who God is and what he's doing in the world and the difference he's making in our own lives. And if you want to be able to do that in a clear, concise, compelling manner, I think one of the best ways to do it is practice. So I want you to go home and work on these three stories. The first one is I want you to go home and you need to become an expert, like we have done all this last year, of talking about God's story. Understanding how God created the world and how he has been working very purposefully through history. We broke it down into these four things. How did God originally create the world? How did he design it to work? How did it look according to his original intent? And then recognizing that we live in a world where there's some pretty messed up things, how do you account for that? How do you answer the question of what went wrong or why do we have the problems that we have in the world? Well, the scripture explains that to us right away, doesn't it? It's because of the fall. Fortunately for us, even after man made a mess of things, God continues in his love to reach out and pursue us, right? And he promised that he would send someone to redeem what was lost. That person is Jesus. That's the story of God's redemption. And the cool thing is God will ultimately restore things back to the way he intended them to be. In fact, he even asks you and I to help bring his kingdom here to earth, to be culture makers in the world where we live, to help reflect his restorative influence in all of creation, wherever we live, work, and play. How can you tell God's story, what he's done, how he's worked through history, really well? Because you need to put it in your own words. You need to have your own vocabulary, street level, family level vocabulary that allows you to talk about this stuff in a concise, compelling manner so that everybody that you run into can understand exactly what you mean. See, that's what Paul models for us. Paul, when he had a Jewish audience, walked through the book of Acts, and you can see how well he does this. And then in Athens, when he has a non-Jewish audience, he's still brilliant at it. And I promise you, it wasn't because it was a spur-of-the-moment thing. It was because he worked, thought, talked, and practiced this stuff. And we ought to do the same thing. The second story that matters is we all ought to understand our own story. We ought to be able to talk to other people about what's the difference that Jesus is making in your life today. You want to be able to talk to other people about the season that you find yourself in life today. How is God actively at work, changing you, working in your life today? Dan made a great point this morning as I was talking with him about this. He said, it's important that you use that word, is making a difference. See, God didn't just make a difference. A lot of us talk about how God made a difference in our lives 20 years ago, way back when. Let me tell you, we talk with other people and we tell them, let me tell you about how God changed my life way back when. Well, you know what? God not only has made a change in your life, but he is making a difference in your life if you're actively pursuing him and following him. And you need to be able to talk with other people about that. See, the relationships that you have, other people see your life. They know what's going on in your life. They know the season that you find yourself in. And you ought to be able to talk with other people in a practical way that they can see, oh, yeah, I know that you're not just talking in religious overtones, but you're talking about your real life because I see your real life and I see where you're messed up. And I see the issues that you have in your family and relationships and at work. And you know what? It's good for me to understand and see a little bit about what God is doing in your life. It tells me that you're in touch with what God is doing in your life. The scary thing is, a lot of us can't do that. And I think there's two primary reasons why we can't talk about what God is doing in our life. The first reason is because we live such an unexamined life that we're just not in touch with what God is doing in our life. That's not a good situation to be in, is it? The second case is even worse than that. And it's probably because God isn't doing anything in your life. And that's not a good situation to find yourself in either. We all ought to be reasoned people as Jesus followers and in touch with where we are and what's going on in our life, what God is trying to teach us through the different things and relationships and difficulties that we may find ourselves in, recognizing that God is at work in all of those details, shaping us to become more like him in the way he designed for each of us to live. And we ought to be able to talk to other people in a compelling way about the difference that he's making in your life. The third story that you need to become an expert in is that's the story of the people of that live in your sphere of influence. Your other family members, the people that you work with, the people that you play with, people that you ski with, whatever you do. You need to know their story because if you have any hope of connecting their real life, everyday living to an eternal God who desires to have a relationship with them, you better understand their life. You need to know a little bit about them. And the only way I know to do that is to listen to other people, hear their stories, know their stories, know their history, know their traditions. If you're like me, you need to know other people's names. That's a great place to start because I'm horrible with names. But you need to be an active listener to understand, to make their stories your own, to be able to help them identify where God is at work in their life. You need to look for other practical opportunities to love them, which means serve them. What are their real life needs, and how can you be a part of loving and serving those people in ways? And just observing their relationships and the things that are going on in their lives so that you can be an expert. When the opportunity arises, not so you can be a busybody, but so that when the opportunity arises for you to have very real, frank conversations with those people, you can speak into their life, not throwing a dart at a dartboard that you have no idea what's going on, but that you can pinpoint because you know them and you know what is going on in their life, you know their stories, and you can help them identify where God is at work or calling them to himself. You need to know those stories, work on them. The last slide I have for you is this. I think it's really tempting that even though Paul was an expert at sharing with other people, whether they were Jews or not Jews, And it's easy for us to make an emphasis on some of those verses in the scripture that tell us your responsibility is to go and tell other people about Jesus. I think it's easy to make formulas and plans and all of this stuff about how we're going to go and make a difference in everybody else's life. But it's all for naught if you don't remember the thing that Jesus emphasized with his audiences over and over and over again. And this is the cool thing, because what he emphasized really didn't matter how well you knew your culture. It really didn't matter if you were, let's say you're an 80-year-old and you've been walking with Jesus for 75 years of your life. Some of you in here may be that person. Some of you in here, you may be a person that, you know, tonight is one of the first times you've ever thought about Jesus and who he is. You're really just kind of exploring this stuff. It doesn't matter which of those two people you are, the one that's been walking with Jesus forever or the person that's just trying to figure out this Jesus stuff. Jesus' purpose and desire for your life is the same. His goals and desire and passions are this, that you would simply desire to obey him in everything. And the funny thing is I was reading these articles this week about sharing your faith with other people, and Dan Kimball, who's a pastor in Santa Cruz, and Rick McKinley, who's a pastor in Oregon, both of them listen to how eerily they say this, talking about sharing with other people. What do they say? Dan says, at the heart of real evangelism, you find men and women simply being themselves and living as, what's the word there? That was horrible. Living as what?
Maturing
Christians. At the heart of being able to have a life that makes an influence or has the opportunity to impact other people, it starts with you just living the way God desires for you to live and live in relationship with him and obeying him right where you're at. Rick McKinley, very similarly, says, real evangelism becomes what? It's the natural byproduct of living that way. See, if you're seeking God and seeking to know what it means to be a culture maker in the world where he puts you and living according to the way he's called you to live, it's funny because a part of that is if you're living in harmony with God, the way he desires for you to live, it's not unlike what you find in Avatar. People watch that movie and they go, oh man, those people have something really cool. And people go, I want to have a life like that. You know what? If you live the way God wants you to live, the way he designed you to live, there is this affinity, I think, that draws other people to go, why do you have what you have in your life? And that will be the basis that you'll have to share with other people, because it's real, it's authentic, it's exciting, and it's powerful. And it creates in other people a hunger to have what you're experiencing in your own life when you're obedient to God. I put together this prayer this week thinking about these scriptures and thought it'd be good to share with you in closing. This is my prayer for you this week. Jesus said, you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. Father, my prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. I am the vine. You are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. So go and make followers of all people in the world. God bless you. Have a great week. Focus on obedience. Become experts in God's story, your story, and the story of people around you. And may you be blessed in making a difference in the world where God called you to live, work, and play.